From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Mohammed El-Shenawy, Senior Middle East Reporter in VOA's English Division. Our guest on this edition of the program is Amy Hawthorne. She's Deputy Director for Research at the Project on Middle East Democracy, and that's a policy group based in Washington. Our topic, Whither Tunisia? Amy Hawthorne is a Middle East expert with extensive policy and practical experience on Arab political reform and democracy promotion. Before joining the Project on Middle East Democracy, Amy was a resident senior fellow with the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East, where she focused on U.S. policy toward Egypt and on U.S. and European strategies to support political and economic reform after the so-called Arab Spring uprisings in 2011. And prior to working at the Atlantic Council, Amy Hawthorne served at the U.S. State Department, where she helped coordinate U.S. support for Egypt's transition and advised on the U.S. response to the Arab Spring, including support for Tunisia. She is the co-author of a recently published report entitled A Transatlantic Strategy for a Democratic Tunisia. We'll talk with Amy Hawthorne about the findings in this report because, as Amy will convey, there is much at stake not only for Tunisia, the country which sparked the democratic uprisings in the Arab world, but also for the entire North African region and the world. We'll also talk about the reasons behind Tunisia's homegrown terrorism. Extremist propaganda has found fertile ground among young, disillusioned, and marginalized Tunisians. While the man who perpetrated the deadly terror attack in Nice was a Tunisian-born Frenchman, French authorities say that Mohamed Louage Boulel appears to have been radicalized very quickly and defies the typical profile of terrorists inspired by the so-called Islamic State. And Amy Hawthorne joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Amy, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague Mohammed El-Shenawy.
Thank you.
Well, Amy, Tunisia, of course, we know is the birthplace of the Arab Spring, even though now so many countries have fallen by the wayside. Tunisia, perhaps the only bright spot among the many countries with the democratic uprisings. Now, you say in your report that it has made great strides toward democracy since 2011, but many challenges remain unaddressed. Numerous economic, security, and political threats could erode progress made so far. But first, talk about progress made to date in Tunisia.
Well, the good side is that Tunisia has put into place the fundamental elements of a democratic system, the very sort of basic elements of free elections, a freely elected parliament, freedom of speech, freedom of association. And so far, 5.5 years after its revolution, those gains have not slipped back. So although many Tunisians, if you go to Tunisia and talk with people, many people, especially young people, are cynical and frustrated, and that's very understandable. But so far, although progress has not at times been fast, they haven't had a backsliding yet. And so they've managed, despite serious economic challenges and several terrible terrorist attacks in the past year or so, basically not to go back on their commitment to creating a democracy. And that's a pretty remarkable thing for a country that has really no tradition of democratic governance, and also that is right next to Libya, which, as we know, is in a violent chaos.
Indeed. Well, speaking of that, now let's talk about the major economic, security, and political threats that beset the country.
Well, it's a bit of a cliche to say that Tunisia's democratic transition is fragile, but it really is. And all of these challenges that it faces are quite interconnected. So on the economic front, demands for better economic conditions, not just for jobs for young people, but good jobs and economic dignity. Tunisians feeling like they could live a life that was respectable and they could earn a decent living and be a valued member of society. Those were among the core demands of the uprising. Unfortunately, as often happens after an authoritarian regime collapses, and we saw the same thing in Central and Eastern Europe, for example, the economy suffers a setback, shocks. And so Tunisia has faced, I would say, a triple economic problem. First is, of course, when there's a major political upheaval and unrest, investors, foreign and domestic, pull out. And so that's what happened in Tunisia in the months after the former dictator Ben Ali was ousted because of the economic uncertainty. Secondly, terrorism. Tunisia does have an active Islamic State network inside the country. And as I mentioned, it borders Libya, where there's a lot of violence and jihadism. And so that has affected the economy as well by keeping tourists away, because there have been, you know, two direct attacks on tourists in Tunisia in 2015. And tourism employs one out of every seven or so Tunisians. So it's a backbone of the economy. So tourism has dried up. And then third is maybe the most difficult problem, which is that although there was a lot of economic discontent under the former authoritarian regime, and people knew they wanted a change and they rose up and demanded something different, something better, there isn't really a consensus now among the key political and economic actors about what kind of economy they want to have. A big segment of the Tunisian population favors a state-led economic model with a lot of government control and social protection, social support. And that is kind of against the sort of market-based reforms that the West would like to see. Some Tunisians actually want to open up the economy, but there isn't a clear economic vision. And there's a lot of risks involved in making difficult reforms. And so for that reason, economic reforms have moved very, very, very slowly. And at times it seems like they've been stuck. So the economic situation is very difficult. And when you go to Tunisia and talk to Tunisians, they are very frustrated because a lot of people did expect that their economic fortunes would improve after the dictatorship was gone. And that has not been the case, which is almost always the case after an authoritarian regime falls.
Indeed. And there's a catch-22, as you said, because the backbone of the economy has been tourism, and now there are terrorist attacks, which of course deters people from traveling and therefore causes greater unemployment. But for more, let me turn to my colleague, Mohamed Al-Shanawi.
Emmy, in a recent nationwide survey of public opinion in Tunisia by the International Republican Institute, 76% of Tunisians describe the economic situation as either somewhat or very bad. What role do you see for the U.S. in helping Tunisia face this economic challenge?
Well, the U.S., and actually together with Europe, and this is really what the recent report that I co-authored was about. It was about making the case for Europe and U.S. cooperation so that we can have more influence working together in Tunisia. But there's a variety of measures that the U.S. and Europe can take to help Tunisia economically. First is what we've already been doing a lot of, which is helping Tunisia with its immediate fiscal challenges. There's been a big drop-off in income and revenue for the state, of course, because the economy is down. Tunisia's had to borrow a lot of money in order to make ends meet. And the U.S. and Europe have provided a number of measures to help Tunisia have access to financing at very favorable terms. That's not a long-term solution. It's a short-term step, but that is one thing that the U.S. can definitely do at relatively little cost to the U.S. Treasury to help Tunisia borrow money on the international markets. Through a loan guarantee, for example, that the U.S. government backs up, can allow Tunisia to borrow a lot of money, and the cost to the U.S. government, U.S. taxpayers, is relatively small. The other thing that the U.S. and Europe can do together, and here Europe is really key because Tunisia is so close to Europe and Europe is its main trading partner. The U.S. is, of course, the most powerful economy in the world and the most important country in the world, but it's very far away from Tunisia. So Europe is really key in terms of creating incentives to open up markets for Tunisian goods in Europe. This is, of course, not easy to do. European domestic constituencies oppose this in some cases. They can promote investment. They can promote tourism. They can show, and the U.S. can show, we have confidence in Tunisia's long-term future, even though the times right now are rocky. So we can send signals of confidence and support to encourage private investors to come in. And we have done some of that. The third thing that I think we can do as outsiders is we can help Tunisia develop sort of the soft skills in its economy that it really needs to develop. And this is where the U.S., I believe, has a lot to offer in terms of helping small and medium businesses, helping entrepreneurship, helping improve education so that the Tunisian workforce will be very attractive and it'll become a desirable place for international investment and for Tunisian investors as well. So it's really up to the Tunisians, of course, but the U.S. and Europe can certainly do some things to help Tunisia at this time.
But is the government doing enough work to improve the economic situation?
The Tunisian government is moving slowly. very slowly on reforms. And there's a package of reforms that the international community and the Tunisian government has been talking about for more than a year. And progress has been slow. And there's a few reasons for this. First is that Tunisia now has a democratically elected parliament and a more open media. So unlike under the dictatorship, when the former leader Ben Ali could push unpopular reforms through, now there's a popular debate and the public can weigh in and say, we don't want that change. And so it's a much more messy process, although healthier in the long run. Secondly, there is a lot of concern among Tunisian leadership about social peace and about creating more unrest through implementing some of the difficult economic reforms that need to be made in terms of, for example, scaling back the government and the private sector. There's a lot of concern in Tunisia that's quite understandable that implementing a serious, robust economic reform package will lead to unrest and upheaval. And Tunisians value stability and social peace, and they don't want that. So it's basically a lot of politics involved in the slow economic progress.
Well, speaking of the economy, you said that there's no consensus yet on which direction the economy should go. But give us a sense of other sectors that Tunisians or the government in particular may want to cultivate in addition to tourism.
Well, to give you just a couple of examples, Tunisia shows actually quite a bit of promise in the IT sector, both in terms of building hardware for export to Europe, because Tunisian labor is cheaper than European labor and is relatively highly educated. They can play a role in actually helping to build microchips and things like that. And in terms of the software, the soft side of IT, there's actually a lot of exciting things going on in that sector. The challenge for Tunisia is that there's no one sector that's going to turn its economy around. Just fixing the problem with tourism isn't enough. Basically, they need to be working on several fronts at once.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Amy Hawthorne. She's Deputy Director for Research at the Project on Middle East Democracy. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Mohamed El-Shenawi. He's Senior Middle East Reporter in VOA's English Division. And this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout-out to a loyal listener, Levan Nizharadze. He's from Paris, France. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Amy Hawthorne, to talk about the social fabric. You alluded to the fact that there's terrorism and there are some homegrown radicals as we speak, and I'd like you to discuss that, the threat that this poses, why that's happening, to what extent, you know, are economic and social conditions contributing to the growth of extremism and maybe this gap between reality and expectations, and the fact that disproportionate numbers seem to be going off to Syria.
Well, it is true that according to publicly reported statistics, more Tunisians have gone to fight with the Islamic State and with other jihadist groups in Syria and Iraq than any other country, which on the face of it is very confusing. Why would a country that has thrown off a brutal dictator and a repressive system that now enjoys freedoms and a lot more opportunities, including for young people, produce this kind of wave? And the reasons are so complex. I wouldn't feel comfortable saying that I know the reason, but some of the factors that experts have talked about include the fact that under the previous dictator, Ben Ali, he kind of looked the other way with radical networks that existed in his country and didn't fully crack down on them and liked the idea of encouraging Tunisian radicals to go outside the country, to go to Iraq, to go to Afghanistan. So one factor is that there's actually a pre-existing pipeline of radicalism in Tunisia. A second reason, of course, is that when the brutal police state sort of collapsed, the police, the Ministry of Interior, fell a bit off course, and their same tactics that they had always used to keep the population more or less in check weren't so much available anymore in terms of mass arrests and torture as the main policies of keeping radicalization under control. With those methods more or less unacceptable, there was suddenly a lot more freedom to organize. And radical Islamists were organizing in the open and bringing Tunisians over to their side. And in the initial years when this was happening, in 2011 and 2012, Tunisian officials didn't always take it seriously. They said, well, we now have a democratic system. We can't clamp down on these people. We want to bring them into the process and allow them to proselytize and reach out to young people. That turned out to be a terrible mistake because they were out in the open. Very little of this was happening secretly. And it turned out that their message had appeal for a lot of young Tunisians. And the third factor, I think, which is quite significant, is that Tunisia change and a democratic transition, of course, because we live in a democracy, we see that as a very positive, favorable, wonderful thing. But for people living in that society, it's huge change. It's a huge sense of uncertainty, dislocation, confusion on the social level. And so a lot of young people feel lost and they're looking for something to belong to while their country, they feel, is sort of adrift. And so there's a real appeal of these radical messages among, unfortunately, many young Tunisians.
Indeed. And of course, as you said, under Ben Ali, some would call that like a secular fundamentalist state, so repressive, repressing any expression of religiosity, legitimate religiosity. And when you take the lid off, you're going to see some people going to the other extreme.
Yes.
And we need to find a way to find a middle ground between the two.
Absolutely.
But also, I guess, the regional economic disparities contributed to that end. So I would ask you, what's needed to avoid a social discontent that could produce radicalization among marginalized, unemployed youth in Tunisia?
Solving Tunisia's youth unemployment problem, which is it has one of the highest rates of youth unemployment in the world, and this is a problem that's existed for a couple of decades. It's not something that was caused by the revolution, but it's gotten worse because of the economic challenges that I described. That is something that will be very good for Tunisia across the board. I am someone who doesn't believe that unemployment is something that is a direct factor to lead people to join a group like ISIS. I think in some cases it can certainly contribute. But in Tunisia, sadly, we've seen young people from all walks of life going to Syria, trying to go to Syria, going to Libya. Some of these people don't have economic opportunity. They have a university degree and they're waiting years to be hired. And they're very frustrated and they're looking for something better. But there are also people who come from good backgrounds, from good jobs, who have also been drawn to this movement. So that's not the only solution, and economic conditions are part of the problem, but not all of it.
Well, I agree with you, Amy, because look at what's going on in Syria. You know, you have a dictator, not too much unlike Ben Ali, you know, Bashar al-Assad, who is cracking down on a peaceful protest. The Syrians were inspired probably by the Tunisian uprising. And then what did he do? He turned around and cracked down brutally on them. And they had no other choice but to defend themselves. And now we're into almost 5 years into this. So people are frustrated, whether they're highly educated or uneducated. And they're very mad that the international community, whether the UN, the United States, the so-called friends of Syria, in their perception, are simply not doing enough to combat Bashar al-Assad, who, one could argue, helped to fuel the rise of the Islamic State, which is equally anathema and equally horrific. Yeah. But I'm just saying that this is a problem, a political problem, that as long as that festers, people of all walks of life will flock to Syria and try to defend their Sunni brethren, whom they think are under a siege by Bashar al-Assad, who is backed to the hilt by Iran, a Shiite power, which, at any rate, we have this power struggle in the region, then Russia.
Absolutely.
As well.
Yeah, I mean, when I was in Tunisia late last fall and I was talking with Tunisian young people about people they knew, friends, neighbors, schoolmates, who had tried to go to Syria to join the Islamic State or who had actually successfully made it to Syria, some of the things that they talked about, of course, were the problem of people not having a good job. And that's a huge social problem in Tunisia for a lot of young people. But they also talked about things that they had heard from their contemporaries in their 20s and early 30s in some cases, that people were looking for, young Tunisians were looking for a sense of belonging, something to believe in, something to dedicate their life to. Now, to us, of course, it seems horrific that anyone would want to look to the Islamic State for that sense of belonging. But the propaganda that has been put out by the Islamic State and its supporters inside Tunisia is very powerful, and it plays on Tunisians' anxieties about the uncertainty in their country and the massive change that is taking place that, again, has many good aspects, but it also is hard. And people's futures are uncertain. And I heard one amazing anecdote about someone who was the son of a high-ranking official in the ruling party of Ben Ali, who had been a staunch supporter of the ruling party and the former president, who opposed the revolution. And then after, a few years after, joined the Islamic State. This is someone who obviously was attracted to extremes, and he went from supporting a secular dictatorship to traveling to Syria and being killed there. So there's a psychological dimension to this that I think is huge, for sure. And one thing that's a bit concerning to me is that Tunisian officials have been very slow to acknowledge that this is a homegrown problem. More often, they like to talk about Libya and the spillover from Libya, which is real. But in fact, this recruitment and radicalization is happening inside Tunisia, of Tunisians by Tunisians. And that's something the government must acknowledge and tackle.
So let's discuss, nonetheless, the spillover from Libya, the chaos, because notwithstanding the many other factors that contribute to Tunisia's struggles, this does not help. You have militias and spillover from the chaos in Libya. You have many Libyans probably fleeing the chaos. To what extent does that contribute, and what can be done, or what is being done to try to thwart that?
Well, it is a legitimate huge problem for Tunisia that there is this chaotic, multi-sided civil war and basically breakdown of the state happening right next door in Libya. Libya has always been a very important, although sometimes difficult, neighbor for Tunisia. The economic links between the countries are quite strong, and so it actually has hurt Tunisia economically to have this chaos in Libya, because there's always been a lot of Tunisians who have gone to Libya looking for higher paying jobs. And then there's a very large number of Libyans, between 1 and 2 million Libyan refugees, who have come to live in Tunisia. And we often hear about the strains that the Syrian refugees are putting on Jordan and Turkey. Of course, this is huge. But Tunisia is also hosting a very large number of refugees from Libya. So what can be done? Well, I think overall, I do give Tunisia credit for actually doing a fairly good job with regard to Libya. They have to really play a very careful role to protect themselves and seek help from the international community to secure their borders, but also to try, when they can, to play a diplomatic and political role with Libyans by trying to serve as an honest broker, hosting different Libyan factions in Tunis, trying quietly, sometimes behind the scenes, to promote a diplomatic political solution. So I think that Tunisia is facing this very difficult situation, and they have to handle it quite carefully. And of course, although they would like the international community to help stabilize Libya, they're understandably very nervous that the West will launch another war in Libya. They don't want that, actually. So they have to play this very careful role. And I do give them actually a fair amount of credit for the mature way that I think they've handled the situation in Libya. That's my personal view.
On a brighter side, a plurality of 61% of Tunisians affirmed their satisfaction with transition to democracy in Tunisia. Does that mean Tunisia is heading in the right direction?
I personally believe that Tunisia is heading in the right direction, because I have the luxury of not being a Tunisian, not living there, and being able to look at it sort of as an analyst and academic from the outside. And from what I can see, looking at Tunisia in comparison to other democratic transitions, that Tunisia has a lot going for it. Many ingredients that bode well for its long-term success. It's a fairly small country. It has a pretty homogenous population. It doesn't have sectarian or ethnic divisions, which is a huge plus. It has a relatively highly educated population. It has a history of relative stability, not civil wars and such in its past. So those are among the factors. And it has the goodwill of the international community. Now, does this mean that Tunisia is guaranteed for success? Of course not. But so far, as I said, they've stayed on the path of moving toward democracy. It's wobbly. At times, it looks like they're going to fall off the path, but then somehow they pull it together and they stay on it. So I'm actually optimistic about Tunisia.
But how would you compare it to the situation in Egypt after
There's
the Arab Spring?
Completely different situation. It's night and day. In Tunisia, the military has never had a significant political or economic role, and the military in Tunisia played an important role in guaranteeing a democratic transition without trying to seize power for itself. And so civilians immediately took over, And Tunisians take pride in what they consider their political culture of consensus and compromise. Indeed, staunch secularists and the formerly outlawed Islamist Party have come together and agreed on a path forward. It's not perfect, but it's better than the alternative. In every way, when Tunisia has been faced and Egypt has been faced with a choice, Tunisia has made, in my opinion, a wise and mature political choice, and Egypt has made a poor choice. There's no comparison between the two countries at this point.
But in your testimony in a congressional hearing, you recommended a recalibration of U.S. policy toward Egypt. What does that entail?
What that would entail, in my view, is the United States making very clear through various instruments that we have, through our massive military aid, our smaller economic aid program, our diplomatic engagement, and so forth, with the Egyptian government, that we are very concerned about the destructive path that Egypt is on. The United States cannot change Egypt's course. We don't have that influence. We never did. But we can certainly not contribute to the problems that Egypt is undergoing. And we can make it perfectly clear with the Egyptian government where we stand and that we're very concerned that the mass repression in Egypt is only going to contribute to instability in the future. So I think there's a number of steps that the U.S. government could take to make our position very, very clear to President el-Sisi. And so far, we haven't really done that fully.
It's probably going to be up to the next administration,
yes,
whichever that will be. As we conclude, Amy Hawthorne, let's talk more about Tunisia. That is the U.S. role vis-a-vis Tunisia. Is that a more sanguine one? Has the administration and our government, in your view, stepped up to the plate with regard to assistance and other kinds of help?
I don't think we fully stepped up to the plate. I think that the Obama administration has done a fairly good job with Tunisia. Overall, we've been supportive of its democratic transition, and we have increased the aid significantly, both security to help them fight terrorism and on the economic front. And we've strengthened our diplomatic relations, which is positive. But when you kind of step back and look at the opportunity that a successful democratic Tunisia could make in the long term for the Arab world, I believe the Obama administration has really fallen short. I don't think that they've truly looked at this as a strategic opportunity that should be a top priority for U.S. policy.
So what you're saying, Amy, is very interesting. What you're saying is, as we alluded to in the introduction, there is a lot at stake in tiny little Tunisia, the birthplace of the Arab Spring, not just obviously for Tunisia itself, not only for the North African region, but also for the entire Arab world. And therefore, the United States should see it as such and perhaps do more, because doing more in Tunisia will have repercussions, positive ones, throughout the Arab world.
Yes, and if we think about over the long term what it could mean for this region to have even just one country that is a successful democracy, it goes against all the narrative of ISIS and the narrative of the Arab dictators that democracy is not possible in this part of the world. And if Tunisia fails, conversely, it sends a terrible message and really goes against the U.S. strategic interests. So that's why the Atlantic Council, we wrote this report about Tunisia, because we were trying to argue that for the U.S. and Europe, helping Tunisia succeed as outsiders, of course, it's always up to the Tunisian people, but outsiders can make an important difference if they provide the right kind of support, that this is a huge strategic opportunity, and therefore we should provide a lot more aid and assistance. We should elevate Tunisia much higher in our diplomatic agenda. And thirdly, that we should work together with Europe, because we really believe, as we wrote this report, that with the U.S. and Europe as outside actors in the Middle East, with limited influence, to be sure, that working together in a very strategic way will only amplify the positive role that we can play. And so we think this is something that, despite all the turmoil in Europe and despite all the other problems that the U.S. is facing in the Middle East, we think this is a pretty easy one. And one thing that we would like to see is we'd love to see, for example, President Obama visiting Tunisia before he leaves office. He's visited Cuba. He's visited Myanmar. What a powerful symbol that would be to have the U.S. president visit small Tunisia, the Middle East's only potential democracy. That would send an incredibly powerful message. So there's a lot more the U.S. can do.
Well, let's hope Mr. Obama is listening. Well, Amy Hawthorne is Deputy Director for Research at the Project on Middle East Democracy here in Washington. Amy, thank you for your precious time and wonderful insights.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Nick Ivanov. And joining me on the program was Mohammed El-Shanawi, senior Middle East reporter in VOA's English division. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.